Accession number 4600, Reel 3.
Flight Lieutenant Townsend, Reel 3. Could you tell me what the crews thought of the two aircraft that you were flying at that time, the Osprey and the Walrus?
Oh, the Osprey went down very well with us on technical grounds. It was a nice aeroplane to look after, I'd say, with the exception of myself, who had pretty out-of-date equipment to play with. But as far as the engine, which was a Rolls-Royce B-12 liquid-cooled beast, was the forerunner of the Merlin, as far as that was concerned, the fitter was very happy indeed, and the rigger was equally happy with the airframe. It was a very nice stainless steel airplane, and very well built. We liked them, and the flying people liked them too, as far as I could tell. One pilot that we had for, unfortunately, only for a few months, was John Casson, Sybil Thorndike's son. And he was a very fine pilot indeed, and used to throw this, really showed us what this Osprey could do in the way of aerobatics. He was very good. And when he went back to his carrier, if he saw the Osprey's aircraft with floats on coming in to land on the water, he would formate on it and make out that he was going to come down on the water too, although he was carrier-borne and had wheels on, and then just peel off at the last minute. But he was a very good pilot, and a very fine conjurer, incidentally. Excellent conjurer. But we thoroughly enjoyed flying with him. Except for the one poor seaman who fancied himself as a telegraphist air gunner and volunteered for training. So we thought we'd give him some air experience first, as he'd never been up in an aeroplane before. And John Casson took him up and threw the airplane around the sky a little bit. And when the aircraft did its customary fly past at deck level to let us know that he was coming in, we saw that the rear cockpit was empty. It wasn't that he'd fallen out, he was just slumped in the bottom in a heap.
And what about the Walrus?
Oh, that was a completely different sort of aeroplane altogether. For a start, it was an amphibian. And so, as far as we were concerned, as the crew, we were very, very relieved indeed to be rid of the beaching trolleys. You see, if you go ashore and your float plane wants to come up a slipway, it means that the crew have to get down into the water and slip beating trolleys in through the floats. And then the aircraft can be pulled up the slipway. And with the Walrus, of course, it was just a question of landing on the hull on the water and dropping its wheels, taxiing up the slipway under its own steam. There's only one snag about that, was that naval pilots, in some cases, are not all that good at believing air instruments and indicating lights and that sort of thing. And we used to get, well, I've seen it myself, where a Walrus had landed on the water and made to drop his wheels and go up a slipway, and the wheels haven't been properly locked down. And so one underleg has collapsed when he's halfway up the slipway and damaged the aeroplane. And that all, of course, is in spite of a klaxon horn blaring away when the throttle is pulled back to warn the pilot to look at the state of his undercarriage. And a green light having to show to indicate that each undercarriage leg was locked down. There was only one green light on and one red light in this particular case, but he still came up the slipway. But I mean, apart from odd things like that, and the fact that if you landed on water with the wheels down, it was a bit catastrophic. It wasn't so bad landing on a grass airfield with the wheels up, because it would slide along on the hull. But with the wheels down, landing on water, it inevitably flipped in. And talking of flipping in, incidentally, the Osprey was a bit of a cow for that, because unless you did a really tail-down touchdown, the tendency was, if there were any waves going at all, the tendency was for the nose of the floats to dig in, and in which case, of course, the airplane would just flip straight over on its back and under the water. And the first pilot we had when I joined the Shropshire was very good at doing this. And I think that it was about the third one that he'd done. He did three before he hurt himself at all. And on the third one, he injured his shoulder and had to go to hospital. And so we lost him. And I think that's where John Casson came in, until a more permanent replacement was found.
Was there any particular reason why naval pilots should be worse at not paying attention to what their instruments told them than other pilots?
Well, that's a good question, because let me make it quite clear. I have a very, very wholesome respect for the Navy. I really do. Having lived with them for 2 years, I shall never forget it, and I do admire them for what they do. But they are used to fairly large lumps of machinery and that sort of thing, and anything as finely controlled as an airplane is, for a lot of them, a bit beyond them. Now, I say, John Casson was one of the finest pilots I've ever flown with, but some of them are distinctly, I mustn't say boneheaded, but they're a little bit thick as far as flying an airplane is concerned. And it's just one of those things. I say, I think it's a question of what one's used to. They are used to dealing with large lumps of machinery and not going terribly fast, and it doesn't matter if you do make a mistake, you can correct it half an hour later. But obviously with an airplane, it's a matter of seconds most often, and you've got to react that much quickly.
You mentioned earlier that you were off the coast of Spain during the Spanish Civil War. Can you tell me more about how the Spanish Civil War affected you?
Well, yes. We spent 9 months at Alexandria at the start of the commission, when the panic was on over Abyssinia. You know, the Italians invaded Abyssinia, and so the British fleet mustered at Alexandria and sat across, really, the Italian supply lines. And I must chip in here that although we didn't particularly want a war on our hands, I'm very certain now that if we'd had a crack at the Italians then, if we'd been allowed to have a crack at the Italians then, we would have stopped them in their tracks over Abyssinia, and could well have prevented Mr. Hitler getting up to his fun and games in Europe. I don't know, but this is how we felt about it at the time.
You felt that you wanted to have a go at the...
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, because they're lovely people. Some of the best friends we've got in Europe, and they're lovely. They're sunny people, but they're not fighters. And, we found afterwards in Mallorca, for example, where we used to go ashore, one of the few places where we could go ashore in Spain when the Civil War was on, and an Italian ship used to land its ship's company also at Mallorca. Well, after the first couple of nights, they found it was much more expedient to land us at a different jetty from the Italians, because the Italians tended to be a little bit quarrelsome, but then they had no stomach for a scrap. But when we'd finished with the Abyssinia do at Alexandria, and the fleet dispersed back to their proper stations, we were in fact leaving Alex, and on that first night we gathered around the loudspeakers listening to the BBC news and heard that the Spanish Civil War had started. And we all guessed, without being told, that this was where we would go next. And in fact, we went to Skiathos for 10 days for a bit of a break, and then off around Spain for the rest of the commission, except the time when we came home for the what would it be, the coronation review. But sorry, we were of course, how it affected us was that we got involved in all sorts of duties. The basic one was to get refugees out of Spain, and this we did regardless of whether they were British or what. There was a big rescue operation went on at mostly based at Barcelona with ourselves and French and Italian and German ships, warships all involved. And also Valencia was the capital then of the government-held bit of Spain, and this was where the British Embassy was, so that we had to have a guard ship at Valencia all the time, just in case the embassy had to be evacuated. And the other thing that we got involved in was around North Spain, where Franco had a battleship, the Jaime Primero, with its attendant destroyer, and they were messing about with shipping on the high seas. So we had to do a patrol off the north coast of Spain between Bilbao and Santander, and do our best to stop Mr. Franco messing about their ships.
How did you actually do that?
Well, this was a bit tricky, because we had to rely, quite frankly, we had to rely on the Spaniard being reasonably disciplined and reasonably gentlemanly about it, because we used to go up and down just outside the 3 mile limit. I mean, there's no question of 200 mile limits in those days. It was 3 miles, period. And we were just outside the 3 mile limit on patrol. And obviously keeping a good WT watch on, was it 500 KCs, I think it was then, the distress frequency, and listen out for any merchant ship that put out an SOS or what have you, any distress sort of signal that he was being stopped. And then we would work up to 25 knots, go to the scene, and position ourselves in between the Franco battleship and the merchant ship. And then, in plain language, in English, we would tell the Spaniard that he must not interfere with British shipping on the high seas. We would tell the merchant ship that he could proceed at his own risk, and which, of course, was a nod or a wink, whichever way you like to look at it, and the merchant ship used to press on in. To stop it, the Spanish battle, the Franco battleship, had to fire his guns, and he would have to fire over us, which is an act of war. Obviously, you don't know if a bloke's going to fire over the top of you or firing at you. So it's an act of war anyway to fire over the top of another warship. And frankly, we called his bluff and persuaded him that he better not shoot anyway. And that's how we got him in.
So in the event, did any of the Franco warships open fire?
No, there was only the one, well, the one and his destroyer. They didn't, they never did, but we called their bluff time and time again. And obviously, at that time, we weren't doing any flying, so there was no work on the aircraft to do. So I was doing watches with the signals people in the ship. And so I was in a good position to know exactly what was going on. And we were, incidentally, of course, when we positioned ourselves between the two ships, we were closed up at action stations, and I can tell you, we had one, we had a round up the spout as well, on the main turrets. But we called their bluff time and time again, and then one night, one Sunday night, the captain, Captain Tate, sent a very, very strongly worded ciphered signal to the Admiralty saying that we were calling the Spaniards' bluff and that he was behaving himself so far, but certainly we couldn't be sure for how long we'd get away with it. And then very, very soon after that, we were hailed by a merchant ship. Obviously, we weren't shadowing the Jaime Primero all the time. We were just going up and down, and he was going up and down, but not the same spot. But we were hailed by a merchant ship, and we set off at a rate of knots and came upon a big circle of wreckage on the surface of the sea, and that was all that was left of the Jaime Primero. Someone had sunk it. How, we never knew. There was talk that it was a coast battery. Somebody else thought it might be an aircraft, government aircraft had had a lucky hit on it and blown it up. But anyway, we were never sure. But anyway, it sank. It sank in a big way, too.
Were there any survivors?
We didn't see any. Quite what happened, I just don't know. The sequel to that was very interesting, incidentally, because towards the end of the 50s, I went to Dublin to talk business with the director of meteorology about Met radars. That was Dr. De Porto. And I said, please, are you Spanish or Portuguese? And he assured me he was a Spaniard. And that he'd been over there for a number of years, which I worked back to, showing that he'd left Spain in about 1936-37. And I said, oh, you got out during the Civil War. I said, where were you? And he said, oh, I was at Bilbao. I said, oh, fantastic. I was within 3 miles or so of you when you were in Bilbao. Whereabouts were you? He said, oh, I had an observatory in the mountains behind Bilbao itself. I said, did you ever hear of the Jaime Primero being sunk? He said, hear of it? He said, I saw it. And not only saw it, but I reported it to the Spanish cabinet, which just happened to be sitting at that very moment. I reported it by telephone to them. I said, well, for heaven's sake, I was there, just after it and saw all the wreckage. And in fact, I had a picture of the wreckage with me, a photograph with me, and I gave it to him at the time.
And how did he say it had been sunk?
He wasn't sure. He certainly wasn't sure. But we were both decided it was sunk all right. Anyway, they were more or less the three types of exercise we were on, taking off refugees and doing guardship at Valencia and also doing a bit of blockade busting off the north coast of Spain.
The refugees you were taking on from Barcelona or Valencia, what kind of people were they and what condition were they in?
Oh, they were, obviously, they were all pretty distressed. The figures that the captain gave us afterwards were that we'd handled something over 10,000 refugees at one time or another we'd had on board. There were 42 different nationalities, and the youngest was a few days old, and the oldest was a dear old nun who was way in her 90s and had never been out of her convent since she went in as a teenage lass. You can guess what they were like. And then at Malaga we had to take off all the inmates of an asylum. They'd just been abandoned by their by the people supposed to be looking after them, and we had to send Marines ashore and bring them back on board. And they were, some of them were in a pretty bad way. There were one or two violent that we had to straitjacket. There's one poor old chap who just stayed where you put him. If you lay him down, he stayed laid down. If you sat him up, he stayed sat up, and that was it. Obviously, we had special arrangements on board to accommodate all these people, but the Malaga lunatics, I'm afraid I shall never forget. They were a pretty sorry sight. and the rest of them, well, the rest of them were you know, I thought the ship's company was fantastic. You know, this is one of the reasons why I say I'll always admire the Navy for what they did, for what I've seen them do. You know, the way the Matlows and so on will play with kids and look after them, and, you know, as though they're trained nurses, they're really quite incredible. And we used to accommodate them as best we could. Obviously, it was only short stay, and the women women and children were all separated from the men for obvious reasons. And we used to put a guard on the women, and the guard, of course, in the ship is automatically a Royal Marine. And because we also were sworn in, as opposed to the sailors who are just under contract to the Admiralty, we also were nobbled for guard duties on the refugees. Again, I didn't take part in that because I was busy on the WT side with the ship signals people. But the only bit of bother that there ever was with the women refugees was over one midshipman, and I don't think he was making any really serious attempt to to get at them or anything like that. It was just one of those things. But there was otherwise there was absolutely no trouble at all, and they were looked after a darn sight better than, you know, they could ever hope to be anywhere else.
So, did you take the refugees then to Britain or to France or where?
No, we used to accommodate them, was to either pick them up ourselves or take them from the destroyer, and then look after them generally overnight stay, and then destroyers would ship them up to Marseille the next day. Now, at Marseille, the League of Nations had a proper refugee organisation on the go, and they used to repatriate them from there. So it was then into the Shropshire, and then off on a destroyer, off to Marseille, and then home after that.
You said earlier that the fleet at Alexandria, the people in the fleet at Alexandria, were keen to have a crack at the Italians. What did they feel about the situation in Spain? Did they think that was any of Britain's business or what?
No, it was it was a completely different kettle of fish. Abyssinia was a very primitive, poor country, being bashed at by supposedly civilized European, fairly wealthy European country, and the altruism crept in, and you know, they felt that way about it, that the Italians certainly shouldn't have been doing it, which of course they shouldn't. But when it came to Spain, it was a civil war, and really, all right, it's the Spaniards' own fight. What they thought about our policy of strict neutrality, I don't really know. I think, the immediate thought about it was that it stopped us going ashore anywhere on mainland Spain, and the only place we could get ashore was in Mallorca. But other than that, you just got on with the job of work and didn't bother your head over much about it.
Did you say earlier that there was a kind of face-up situation with the Italians on Mallorca?
Oh, yes. We used to have little kerfuffles with them, you know, when we both got ashore, and I suppose after... So when Jolly Jack's been penned up for 2, 3, 4 weeks with no shore leave and darkened ship every night, he gets a little bit restive, and you know, we appreciated this because we used to feel exactly the same way about it. It gets your nerves on edge. and you're only too happy to get ashore and be able to take a walk or go and have a beer or something like that, because you see, in a ship you're quite dry, you have nothing to drink. There are no drinks allowed, period, except in the wardroom. So okay, the boys go ashore and have a few beers, and some of them get a bit belligerent and pick on the first foreigner they can come across, I suppose. There was a bit of trouble between the Italians and ourselves. And I say they had to land us at different jetties after the first night or two. But what we did find was that the Italians had no stomach for a fight. I know myself that, I don't go around looking for fights, but I know that you come across some, three or four Italians, and they would, when they saw us, they'd link arms and string themselves across the pavement, you see, to force us off. But if you walk straight up the middle, they break. That sort of small thing, shows up. But the Germans, of course, a different kettle of fish altogether. For some peculiar reason, which we could never make out, the German sailors always saluted us airmen. I don't know why, but they always did. They didn't salute the sailors, but they saluted the airmen. Whether they just didn't recognise our uniform, I just don't know. But anyway, they always chucked us up a very smart salute. And incidentally, the difference between the two sides in Spain was so pronounced. Obviously, we saw ships of both sides. The Franco ships were always clean, tidy, well painted. When they came in harbour, they dressed ship properly, crew all lined up on the upper deck and so on, and proper bosun's whistles going, that sort of thing. When a government ship came in, it was just a shambles. Just a shambles, people loafing around the upper deck and smoking and goodness knows what all. A mess, which we certainly weren't used to.
So they didn't seem to be under any kind of discipline?
No, absolutely none. Oh no, the discipline on the government side was very slack, and there were an awful lot of cases of people who were inclined to be anarchists, taking the law into their own hands. And I'm sure from what we saw and heard at Barcelona that there are a lot of family feuds were settled under the guise of people being, capitalist or what have you, and somebody else saying he was a communist and having a shot at him. Or putting him up, putting through the motions of a silly little trial and then shooting him at night. Every night in the fort, looking over Barcelona, you could hear shots, the usual shots going, and somebody else had bought it.
The Germans you said that you ran into, these were German military?
German Navy.
Mallorca.
German Navy, yes. Oh yes, the Germans and Italians were blithely assembling aeroplanes on Mallorca. No two ways about that. They, of course, were neutral, just the same as we were supposed to be, but Italian and German aircraft being assembled there. It's all those.